All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be taking a close look at a pretty fascinating case. It's the 1987 State v. Rice Hill decision out of the North Dakota Supreme Court.
Ooh, yeah, this is a good one. It really digs into this really interesting tension. You know, the tension between the right to bear arms and the state's got to keep people safe, right?
Exactly. And then on top of that, you have this whole other layer. What happens when a defendant is basically saying, my lawyer messed up, like, I didn't get good representation, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Ineffective assistance of counsel, that's a big one. We see it come up all the time.
All the time, right. Yeah. And you actually flagged this case for us, and it's perfect. You know, we talk a lot about constitutional law. We talk about criminal procedure. And even just, like, how do appeals courts work? You know, this case kind of hits all those points. So before we get too deep into the weeds here, maybe just for our listeners who might not be familiar with this case, set the stage for us. What are the facts? What happened here? What brings us to the North Dakota Supreme Court?
Okay, so picture this. It's March 1986. A guy named Mark Schmetz goes to the police. He's saying Elliot Ricehill, the guy at the center of this whole thing, showed him a rifle and a revolver while they were in a car together.
Okay, so right off the bat, we've got guns involved. Uh-oh.
Right. Later that same day, police pull over a car. It's Ricehill's wife driving. Ricehill's in the passenger seat. They see an open beer can right there at his feet.
Open container. Okay.
Right. Yep. That's what gets him arrested. An open container violation. But here's where it gets interesting. They search the car after the arrest, and what do they find?
I'm guessing the rifle and revolver?
Bingo. The exact guns Schmetz described.
Okay, so now it's more than just an open container, right? We're talking potential weapons charges. But I have a feeling there's something more to this, right? Like, why is this case so important?
Here's the kicker. Ricehill had a prior murder conviction.
Oh, wow. Okay, that changes things significantly.
Right. So because of this prior conviction, they charge him under a specific North Dakota law. It's a North Dakota statute, section 62.100201. Basically, this law says if you've been convicted of a violent felony, like murder in this case, you can't have a gun for 10 years after you get out of prison.
So the state's saying, look, you already did something really serious. We can't risk you having a gun. What did Ricehill say to all this? How did he defend himself?
So his defense at trial had a couple of parts. First, he said the guns weren't his. He's saying they belonged to his wife and he hadn't even touched them. He went so far as to say that he couldn't have shown the revolver to Schmetz.
Because he was locked up or something?
Yeah, he claimed he was locked in the glove compartment and he didn't have the keys.
Okay, so he's denying any possession. He's denying ownership. But obviously this wasn't just a simple he said, she said. This went all the way to the Supreme Court. So what were the big legal issues here?
So this is where it gets really interesting. Ricehill basically raises two huge legal challenges. The first one is a constitutional argument. He's saying this North Dakota law, the one that says I can't have a gun because I'm a felon, it violates my right to bear arms. He's pointing to Article 1, Section 1 of the North Dakota Constitution.
That's a big one. So it's individual rights versus, I guess, the state's interest in keeping people safe.
Right, right. And this is what we have to talk about, police power. It's like this fundamental power that states have. It's their authority to make laws to protect the health, safety, you know, the general well-being of their citizens. It's a huge part of how states function.
Okay, so you've got Ricehill saying, my constitutional rights are being trampled on. And you've got the state saying, hold on, we have a duty to protect everyone. And sometimes that means limiting certain rights. So how did the court sort this out?
Well, the court sided with the state. They upheld the law and said it didn't violate the Constitution. And the key to their decision is this idea that the right to bear arms, while important, isn't unlimited. It can be regulated reasonably under the state's police power.
So it's about finding that balance, that sweet spot. What did the court focus on when they were deciding whether this restriction was reasonable, you know, specifically targeting someone with a violent felony conviction?
Public safety. That was their main concern. And there's this one line in the decision that really sums it up. The court said, and I'm quoting here, it is patently reasonable for the legislature to conclude that keeping firearms out of the hands of people who have shown a disposition to harm others is a way to protect public welfare. Basically, they're saying, look, this guy has a history of violence. If we let him have a gun, there's a good chance he could hurt someone.
Makes sense. They're drawing a line saying this is where your individual right has to yield to the safety of the community.
Exactly. And the court was very clear that this law wasn't just targeting all felons. It was specifically focused on violent felons. That distinction was really important to them.
It's like they're saying, We're not saying you can never have a gun, but given your past, we need to be extra careful.
Right. And this idea that the right to bear arms has to be balanced against the state's police power, it's actually a pretty big deal. The court even says the right to bear arms must be read in conjunction with the state's exercise of the police power.
It's not like one completely overrides the other. They have to exist together.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the first big legal argument. Now let's talk about the second one. Ineffective assistance of counsel. Raisel's basically saying his lawyer dropped the ball, right?
Right. So his argument here is focused on a really core right we have in our legal system. It's the right to have a lawyer who can effectively represent you. It's in the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it's also in the North Dakota Constitution. Raisel is saying his lawyer messed up big time. Specifically, he waited until the day before the trial to request a subpoena for a potential alibi witness. This guy, Curtis Posey.
So a subpoena is basically a legal order to make someone show up in court and testify, right?
Yep, exactly. And because the lawyer waited until the last minute, there was no time to actually serve Posey with the subpoena, so he never showed up to testify.
So Raisel's thinking is, if my lawyer had done his job, this guy Posey could have backed up my story. Maybe the jury would have seen things differently.
Exactly. He's arguing that Posey could have helped his case, maybe supported his claim that he didn't have access to the guns, and his lawyer's mistake robbed him of that chance. And this brings us to a really important legal test. It's called the Strickland test. It comes from a Supreme Court case, Strickland v. Washington. And it's what courts use to figure out if someone's lawyer was actually ineffective.
So walk us through the Strickland test. What does someone have to prove to win an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
It's a two-part test. First, you have to show that your lawyer's performance was deficient. Like they messed up in a way that a reasonable, competent lawyer wouldn't have. And second, you have to show that this messed up performance actually hurt your case. You know, there's a good chance the outcome would have been different if your lawyer had done their job properly.
Okay, so it's not just about the lawyer making a mistake. It's about whether that mistake actually changed things.
Right. So in Raisel's case, he's saying that his lawyer's super late subpoena request, that was the deficient performance. And the prejudice, the harm, is that he lost the chance to have Posey's testimony help his case. But here's the thing. The North Dakota Supreme Court, they didn't actually rule on whether Raisel's lawyer was ineffective.
Really? Why not? If that was his argument, shouldn't they have addressed it?
They said they didn't have enough information to make a decision. They looked at the record from the trial, and they said it was insufficient to determine if the lawyer was ineffective and if that ineffectiveness actually changed the outcome of the trial.
So it's like they're saying, we don't know enough about what this witness would have said or why the lawyer waited so long to request the subpoena. We can't make a ruling based on what we have.
Right. And this is a really good example of how appeals courts work. They're mainly focused on what happened at the trial based on the official record. If something wasn't fully explained or documented at the trial, it's really hard to argue it on appeal.
So it's like, you had your chance at trial. We're not going to relitigate the whole thing based on new information.
Exactly. So the Supreme Court upheld Raisel's conviction, but they did something interesting. They affirmed it without prejudice to him raising the ineffective assistance claim in a different legal proceeding, something called post-conviction relief.
Without prejudice. So that means?
It means they're not saying he's wrong about the ineffective assistance thing. They're just saying this isn't the right place to decide that issue. You can try again somewhere else.
Okay, so it's not a total dead end for him on that issue.
Nope. He could file a separate legal action, try to bring in new evidence like testimony from Posey, and really try to prove that his lawyer messed up and it cost him the case.
So for everyone listening, especially those of you in law school, what are the big lessons here? What do we take away from State v. Raisel?
Okay, so big picture. Constitutional rights, even the ones we consider really important, like the right to bear arms, they're not absolute. The state can put limits on them, especially when it comes to public safety.
And the court really seemed to care that this North Dakota law was focused on people who had already been convicted of violent crimes. It wasn't a blanket ban on everyone owning guns.
Right. Laws that are tailored to specific groups that are seen as a higher risk, those are more likely to be considered reasonable. And the court really hammered home that balance between the right to bear arms and the state's police power.
What about the ineffective assistance of counsel issue? What should future lawyers learn from that part of the case?
I think the main takeaway is that if you're going to argue your lawyer was ineffective, you're going to need a lot of evidence. And a direct appeal right after the trial might not be the best place to do that. You might need a separate legal action, like a post-conviction relief proceeding, where you can build a stronger case.
So pay attention to the procedure, to the process. Know when and where to raise certain arguments.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been a really interesting look at State v. Rice Hill. It shows just how complicated these issues can be. Balancing individual rights with public safety, figuring out what makes a law reasonable. It's not easy. And for those of you studying law, this kind of case is exactly what you're going to be dealing with. These big fundamental questions about how our legal system works. So I'll leave you with this. The court said this restriction on gun ownership for violent felons was reasonable because of the risk to public safety. But where do we draw the line? Could the state use this same reasoning to restrict gun ownership for other groups of people? It's a question we're thinking about. And State v. Rice Hill gives us a really good starting point for that conversation. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
It's been fun, like always.
We'll see you next time.